It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The New York Times' consumer technology writer says email addresses have become a digital breadcrumb for companies to link a person's activity across sites. We discuss privacy and what to think about before handing over our personal email address. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Conversation is right here at 800-642-1234. Michael Domke is here, director of the Bureau of Consumer Protection. Division is part of the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Michael, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So your agency lists this top 10 consumer complaints, includes email spoofing and phishing in there. How are scammers finding email addresses to send these bogus emails to get our personal information?
Well, I would say most often they're finding them because we're entering them. Mm. And it's become a regular part of an online presence, whether it be shopping, trying to research news, anything like that. A most common thing to be able to communicate back and forth now is email, because it's kind of where the world's become comfortable with.
Tell us about what is risky about sharing a personal email address.
Well, it seems like a benign factor, but what's interesting about the email address is when it's being used just as that single source logon, a lot of people get comfortable with that because they feel that none of their personal identity is being tied to it. And if you are just entering that single email, that's correct. But what they don't know is that there's a lot of companies that are aggregating and combining this information behind the scenes, where you've entered that email in conjunction with 1, 2, 3, 4 other pieces of information on another site. So for instance, you want to go on and you want to make a purchase, and it asks for your name, your mailing address, so they can send it to you, potentially their phone number, so they can call you if something goes wrong, and of course your email address for confirmation. Well, now those four things are all tied to your email. So then if you add your emails at another site and another site and another site, and these companies all, you know, work with someone who combines that data together, they've now created a picture and kind of tailored your profile as to what your interests are and where you visit just by your email.
It's kind of like you're filling up the kitchen garbage can, and yet these are all very detailed personal little tidbits about you that are building a portrait.
They are. And, you know, and it's so misleading, because you think that you aren't actually entering that information, and unbeknownst to you, all of this is being compiled and built so that retailers and marketers can say, all right, I know that, you know, Michael is interested in this particular product, so I'm going to tailor my marketing to him on all these other sites when you didn't realize it. And that's how that one piece can really add so much more and potentially expose yourself to maybe even identity theft or something worse, because it's starting to build a bigger profile that becomes very lucrative and or interesting for someone who wants to misuse it.
You mentioned retailers. Who is collecting this information? Who is building these profiles?
I would say everyone is building the profiles, you know, whether it be through the email address that you enter on a particular website, but also, you know, in the apps that we use on our phones or the websites that we visit on our PCs. So a lot of those have settings. And so the app itself is tracking the information. So it's not just creating a picture that only retailers or marketers are advertising. There's a vested interest in anyone that you has a presence on your device to know what you're doing, so they can better maximize your experience, thus have you using their particular app more often.
We received a listener email here at ideas at WPR.org, and the listener says that they heard it may be unsafe to use the unsubscribe link, or the, you know, that button at the bottom of emails to unsubscribe. Is this guidance true in some cases?
In some cases, it may be. You know, so it depends on whether or not you have a reliable email, I would say, app. So a lot of the email providers will now offer an unsubscribe option at the bottom of them. And I would say if it's being driven through an app that you trust, by and large, they're going to send that message to that particular retailer, whoever's sending the sender, and it should work. The other is the unsubscribe that is required to be in the actual email itself. And that's where the danger lies, is if you get a spam mail or something that is truly unsolicited and has malicious intent behind it, and there's that old unsubscribe, you're now clicking on that link within it. So I would recommend that if you're using an app, an email software that offers that directly through them, that's safer than clicking on the link directly within the email.
If you delete suspicious email or ones that crept through your spam filter, is that good enough? Is simply deleting from your inbox enough, or would you recommend other steps?
Well, you certainly could. I mean, deleting them will get rid of them. The most important factor is to not click on any of those unsolicited links in there. All of the phone numbers, don't open the email, don't open any attachments. So deleting is certainly a good step to start with. Another is there is some, I would say, higher tech email programs that will filter them out and make sure that they delete them out of the way. Some of them you have to pay for. But the best step is what you just started with, is get rid of it right away. Don't look at it again. You should be okay.
Michael Domke, Director of the State's Bureau of Consumer Protection on juggling email, how to protect personal information from being exposed. Join in with your approach to email privacy, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our emails, they contain tracking pixels and the code sending data to the email sender, like when we opened the email and the location of where we opened it. Call in about email address privacy concerns, 800-642-1234. Conversation is at 800-642-1234. Michael Domke is Director of the Bureau of Consumer Protection and stays with us. So, Michael, you know, we have this thing where retailers, they are offering discounts and coupons and special sales codes through their email marketing programs. How do we balance that retail savings and email privacy?
Well, certainly if you want to take advantage of those savings, they're going to single stream your ability to get that and then it's the email. And most oftentimes, they're also going to, as part of their terms and conditions, allow you to receive more marketing emails from them. So that's going to be a personal choice on whether that discount is worth, you know, receiving a few more emails or maybe that mailbox getting cluttered. One thing you can do to kind of maybe circumvent that a little bit is just create a singular email that's only used for online shopping discounts to receive those kinds of things. It helps, doesn't necessarily protect you perfectly. And of course, if you're going to use that email to log in and make purchases, that's going to make it a little more challenging to keep that somewhat anonymous. But another opportunity you can do is sometimes you have operating software on your devices that will mask your email and what's being sent. So it'll allow that communication back and forth to get that discount. Maybe that's the one time thing that you need. Maybe you think you're going to be on a regular basis. So you do want to create, you know, a regular communication to get those. But it comes down to a personal choice and some little things you can do to hopefully prevent yourself from being victimized.
So this email masking or email masks, these are randomly generated email addresses that can be used in place of your real personal email address?
They are. It's very similar to encryption that gets sent over, and it's being done through the operating system of the particular device that you're on. There also are third-party software programs that will do this for you. And so you send out your email address that is really 123@email.com. And what they're seeing is this very, very long string of characters on the receiving end. And it's very difficult to decrypt that. And then, of course, when they send it back, it gets back to where it should go. So it's one opportunity to do it. But again, we're making it, I don't want to make it sound like using your email address should never, ever be done. Certainly there are good ways to do that. We're just saying through a few preventative tips can put you in a better place to use it online safely.
Should we buy a plan for email masking and incorporate it into our, like, our digital hygiene and our digital privacy hygiene?
I don't know that you would have to, that it's necessary to make a purchase. I think, okay, a lot of the things we talked about here today certainly would be, are achievable. They're free. It's all about a couple preventative steps to really just put your, to go a long way in putting yourself in a better position.
In the time we have left, I was wondering if you could touch on your agency's budget request, an additional $20 million in the state's next two-year budget. We're going to hear, of course, Governor Evers making his state budget message tonight. Is your agency seeking funding to improve consumer protections in Wisconsin?
That is actually a topic I don't have a lot of information on. I know that he's going to be reviewing the budget we submit, and then, of course, there's different things that happen throughout there. So we do always look for, of course, funding to continue our consumer protection efforts so we can have opportunities to talk like this. We can offer our resources on the website. We can get out into the public and talk to them about what they can do to prevent themselves, not just on email protection, but a variety of other things like identity theft and making sure they're not victimized with fraud. So all these things go a long way in making sure that their personal interests are taken to heart. And hopefully as an agency, we're able to do that.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Michael Domke is director of the Bureau of Consumer Protection. It's part of the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore how wealthy out-of-state investment firms are increasingly buying up the city's most affordable homes and how this activity is changing neighborhoods. Colin, about changes in recent years to Milwaukee's housing market, what you see occurring in your community, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. John Johnson is a research fellow at the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education at Marquette University. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks.
Well, can you set the scene for us and tour us through the numbers a bit, what you see, how involved are out-of-state investors in Milwaukee's housing market?
Yeah, I think it's best to start back in the 1990s and the early 2000s. In that period, homeownership in the city of Milwaukee was a consistent about 80% of the city's houses. So we're not talking about apartment buildings, just single-family homes, duplexes, triplexes, condos, the kinds of places a family might buy to live in. So 80% of those were owner-occupied consistently before the housing crisis. And then over the course of the Great Recession and the housing crisis, really lasting up through 2018, homeownership fell precipitously in the city. It fell overall by 12 percentage points, or about 16,000 houses that exited owner occupancy over that period. And, you know, Milwaukee isn't Detroit. Most of these houses were not being abandoned. Instead, they were purchased by landlords. And increasingly, they were purchased by landlords based outside of Wisconsin entirely, particularly states like California and Florida and Texas in that original wave of investment. Out-of-state ownership has grown by 479% since 2005, and it's grown by 51% since just 2017. These kinds of landlords now own more than one in six of the rental properties in the city. But really, two things have happened under the hood if we look more closely. So during that first period from about 2005 through 2018, this out-of-state investment was driven by smaller, usually individual investors. I think of these as like single-digit millionaires from places like California, as I mentioned, and these buyers would assemble small portfolios in the city, a couple properties up to, you know, maybe a dozen or a couple dozen at the very largest, And then they would contract with local property managers to run the operations of their little business here. In some cases, we know that these landlords never even visited the city at all throughout that process. But in the last 4 years, we've seen something new, which is that this handful of private equity-backed, very large, vertically integrated firms had begun building these enormous portfolios of single-family and duplex rentals in the city. Right now, we believe there are three of these companies, and they own just about 1,500 properties in the city,
wow,
which is up from just about 80 4 years ago.
Who do they get to manage these properties then?
They provide all of that in-house. So in-house, in contrast to the other companies we talked about, yeah, these are vertically integrated.
It seems, though, Milwaukee is following a national trend here where you see this activity in majority Black neighborhoods. What is the effect on certain neighborhoods and on people of color?
Yeah, in Milwaukee, this has recently been occurring exclusively in majority Black neighborhoods. Out-of-state investment over the last 4 years declined in majority white neighborhoods, and it grew by about 1,900 properties in majority Black neighborhoods. One of the effects of this is that it makes it more difficult for people who would like to be home buyers to buy houses there. And in the last 4 years, we've seen an enormous increase in home buyer activity across the city of Milwaukee, which is encouraging. That comes on the heels of this very long decline. In the last 4 years, we've seen a net of 3,000 new owner occupiers across the city. So those are 3,000 houses switching to owner occupation from being owned usually by a landlord. And a lot of that growth has happened in neighborhoods where homes are pretty affordable. Think this, you know, sort of $90,000 to $130,000 range. And those are exactly the houses that these large firms are targeting, that they're aiming to buy up. Now, what's really interesting to me is that in the early 2010s, in that sort of first wave after the housing crisis, investors were buying houses that had been owned by owner occupiers, you know, out of sheriff sales, foreclosures from flippers, that kind of thing. But now we're seeing these large companies buying out the small portfolios of the landlords who came before them.
Oh.
And they're increasingly doing this off of MLS. They're increasingly finding these landlords outside of the market that's accessible to would-be homebuyers. And they're often buying multiple properties at the same time, sometimes for cash. So they, in fact, aren't out-competing would-be homebuyers on price. They usually get very good deals and pay slightly less than those houses would sell for if they were listed individually on the open market. But they can offer landlords who are selling the convenience of speed, closing without contingencies, and maybe even selling all of their properties in one transaction.
Becomes very neat and tidy, if you will. I'm going to just reintroduce you for a moment. John Johnson, Research Fellow at the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education at Marquette University. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Maddie in De Pere has something. Maddie, go ahead.
I have a question. I follow a wide range of news media for years, and I was aware that China had purchased numerous hotels in our country. They also had investors from China that purchased, I guess the governor of Montana and one of the Dakotas was complaining about China buying up so much farmland. And is it possible that China, investors from China, are purchasing these buildings in Milwaukee?
And Maddie, thank you. And we're going to talk about foreign investment in farmland tomorrow. But, you know, what about foreign investment in the housing market in Milwaukee, John?
It's something I've gotten questions about, and I have tried to look into. It seems like foreign investors in Milwaukee, at least, are mostly focusing on commercial real estate if they do properties, and less so houses, though, with a few exceptions, but I haven't seen any investors from China specifically, more from Israel, in fact.
How does it affect a neighborhood's home prices and home values in, you know, when an investor swoops in and pays all cash or bids up a sale?
Indirectly. So a lot of those transactions, it's sort of complicated to say. A lot of those transactions don't qualify as like the kind of arm's length things that affect assessments directly. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they reduce the number of properties that are potentially going to be going on the market one by one. And that reduction of inventory, the literature shows, appears to drive up prices somewhat. Even though those landlords are often paying a little bit less than the houses they bought would have sold for if they were listed on the individual market. But it does seem to contribute to an upward pressure in prices.
Governor Evers is proposing a whole bunch of housing and renter protections in his biennial budget. What regulations would you propose to put a check on out-of-state investors and landlords?
The very simplest place to start would be requiring landlords to register with the city, which is something that Milwaukee is currently prohibited from doing, as I understand it, by the state government, just so you can keep tabs on who's there and what they're doing. In general, no perfect solution has been found yet. Different jurisdictions are experimenting with a variety of approaches. We're very limited in what we can do in Milwaukee, but these companies are very clear when they communicate with their investors that they're concerned about the regulatory environment in any market they enter. So it's good for cities to vigorously protect tenants using whatever tools they have, and that will be discouraging to investors who are purely looking for where they can make the most profit.
So should local governments have more autonomy from the state in order to enact ordinances that could regulate the landlord-tenant relationship better?
I think so. I think cities understand their unique needs and their circumstances in this regard better than the state government can. Certainly, I think it's the case in Milwaukee that we understand our situation pretty well, and we just lack the tools to address it currently.
How does Milwaukee, though, compare to the Sun Belt or the, you know, other hot markets in the South, you know, when you look at the turnover in Milwaukee?
Yeah, some listeners, I'm sure, will have read stories about very large private equity landlords like Invitation Homes, American Homes for Rent, Tricon, these companies that really pioneered the business model. And they all focused initially and really mostly to the present on the Sun Belt. We didn't see this kind of private equity investment in single family homes and duplexes in Milwaukee until very recently. So it's really the extension of a Sun Belt business model to the Rust Belt. And they're finding that it works well here because rents are really quite high compared to property values in cities like Milwaukee.
And we only have a few seconds left, but where does this research go from here, and what are you watching for in the numbers?
It's a moving target. These companies entered not that long ago, and they're scaling up very rapidly to date. But as we move into an increasingly high interest rate environment with the threat of a recession looming, it's not clear what the future holds. Home buyer activity has fallen off precipitously. Is that going to also decrease the activity of these investors, or is that going to create a new opportunity for them to grow even faster? What happens if we have a new foreclosure crisis? Mm-hmm. These are all questions that we'll be looking at closely going forward.
John, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
John Johnson is a research fellow at the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education at Marquette. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.